Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where you'll find broad topics, an unconventional dyad, and one shared goal, educating ourselves through challenging and engaging conversations. Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to having discussions that are real, raw, and unpolished. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Unconventional Dyad podcast listeners. We are so excited that you are joining the conversation with us. If you're liking what you're hearing and you would like to support the podcast, there are a few different ways to do that. We have a Patreon page now, so if you visit patreon.com/unconventionaldyad, you can support us through four different support tiers. You can also support us through the Anchor app. There's a support function, and you can choose from three different tiers, from as little as 99 cents per month. We really hope that you are liking the content so far. You can also check out our website, where we post weekly blogs that you can comment on, and we hope that you join in the conversation with us. Let us know what you think.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 3 of the Unconventional Dyad podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Laura, and I'm actually your only host for today's episode. Carly will not be joining us today due to other commitments, but we do have a very exciting episode today. It's our very first guest on the podcast, and I'm very excited to be speaking with her. Her name is Laura Schrader. So I will tell you a little bit about Laura, and then we'll get into the conversation. Laura is the co-founder of Open Americas, which is an online platform for sharing content that engages with contemporary social issues facing the Western Hemisphere. She is also the communications and strategic partnership manager at Open Americas, and she currently works as the investor and communications manager at Working Capital for Community Needs, which is a nonprofit organization with headquarters in Wisconsin. And Working Capital's mission is to create opportunities for access to microfinance, services, and markets to improve the lives and communities of the working poor in Latin America. Laura has a bachelor's degree in sociology and anthropology, as well as a minor in environmental studies from Lewis and Clark College. And she has a master's degree in international policy and development from Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. Laura is also a personal friend of mine. We met in middle school, and we've stayed friends over the years, so I know Laura on a personal level, and I have been truly, truly inspired by her genuine kindness, as well as her heart and passion for human rights and for serving others. Laura, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Laura. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, let's get started talking about you a little bit more. Why don't you tell our listeners who you are?
Sure. So I can talk a little bit about some of my identities, personal and professional. First, personally, I should say that I'm a white cis woman, which informs the way that I navigate the world and the way that I'm perceived and treated and afforded certain privileges. I also consider myself a lifelong learner. I've been a student for a very long time. I'm no longer a student, but continue to try to learn new things and put myself in positions where I'll grow and be challenged. Conversations like this, I think, is a good example of those types of positions and situations. I also have a lot of identities that are very relational. I'm a friend, a neighbor, a daughter, a sister, a partner. And so I think who I am in relation to my community is something that's also very important to me. And it's also really interesting to note how my identity changes based on who I'm with, where I am, kind of how that shifts situationally. So for the longest time, I've lived outside of the Midwest, and being a Midwesterner, being from Wisconsin, is a really big part of my identity that I accentuate for people. Now, not as much now that I'm back in the Midwest. I've also lived abroad a fair amount. And so being from the US was a big part of my identity then. So it's interesting to see kind of how it shifted throughout the ages and based on where I am.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really interesting point that our identities do change depending on maybe what period of life we're in, what area of the world we're living in at the time. That's a really good point that I don't really think about too often. Tell me a little bit about your lifelong learner identity, because I think this is something I definitely knew about you on a subconscious level, but I never really put words to. And I think part of the reason we are probably friends is because of that shared identity. I also consider myself a lifelong learner, and I want to hear more about what that means to you. What does it mean to be a lifelong learner? What does that look like in your life?
Sure. I think a lot of it means challenging myself to constantly take in different viewpoints, to take in new information about topics that I haven't necessarily come into contact with before. I think it means signing up for classes. I've taken a lot of free Mandarin classes with other students. I've dabbled in Duolingo, although that hasn't been going super well. So,
Yes.
really just getting curious about the world and interacting with people and material that help me keep learning and growing.
That's awesome. Where do you think that comes from for you?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think that a lot of it comes from my family. My mother has had a couple of very different careers. So she started out as a speech language pathologist and then completely pivoted to being an environmental educator and learning everything there is to know about monarch migration, firefly, kind of patterns as they flash at night. It's been super
Wow.
interesting to see kind of her completely pivot and become an expert on something totally new. So I think I've been inspired by that, as well as my dad and others close to me.
That's incredible. I didn't know that about your mom. That's pretty impressive. And I'm not surprised that you're also the type of person who's able to just kind of be a chameleon in all these different areas of your life. So that's pretty cool. I also think of you. And maybe this is just a label that I've put on you, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I also think of you as a human rights activist. For some reason, every time I think of you, that's an identity that pops up in my head. I wonder if you identify that way.
Yeah, I do definitely identify as an activist. I think it's difficult because sometimes it seems like a more prominent part of my identity than other times, based on the actions that I'm taking. And I've found it really difficult to find where to get involved lately, especially given the current circumstances with COVID. So sometimes it does feel more accentuated, but I do feel really strongly about human rights, kind of transnational activism, and especially labor rights, and environmental justice, and have tried to learn more about those topics and get involved with those as well.
Yeah, where do you think this activist identity comes from for you? Is it something else that you've kind of learned from your parents? Is it something you've developed on your own? When did it kind of start for you? I'm just so curious about it.
Yeah, I think a lot of it did come from my parents. I think that I learned a lot of empathy from them, especially when my mother was a speech language pathologist. She worked with a lot of folks who had injuries that prevented them from speaking and communicating. And I kind of learned that everybody really experiences the need to communicate, to be seen and understood and validated. And that a lot of folks are denied that based on inherent characteristics or their religion or their sexual orientation. And then that happens in the US and across the world. And my dad is actually a counselor or was a counselor. And he helped folks find rewarding careers. And so I think that that fostered a lot of empathy in me and interest in social justice and kind of giving people access to what they need to thrive. And breaking down inequitable structures that exist here and all over the world. So,
I love that so much. I feel like your family just sounds like a nice little hub of empathy and compassion. It sounds wonderful. I mean, it's great that all of you are involved in that on some level. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I guess I'm wondering too, in terms of activism, maybe what age that kind of popped up for you, and when you started thinking of yourself in that way?
That's a really good question as well. I was actually going through some of my old things in my childhood room and cleaning them out, and I came across a really embarrassing diary from third grade.
Nice.
And besides, you know, talking about crushes and who's in a fight with who, I found this letter that I drafted with friends to President George W. Bush about oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And incredible.
We never sent it, but I had that drive to be an activist and was aware of these issues at 10. I don't know when it started, but yeah, it was pretty funny on. To read.
Yeah, I bet. How cool. That's really funny. Do you know why you didn't end up sending it off?
I think I probably just forgot about it. It was also, you know, the letter went something like, "Dear President Bush, we are 6th third grade girls. We disagree with you. We want to talk with you about it."
I love it. Oh my goodness. Who knows how different the world might be if you would have gotten to speak with him. And
we'll never know. We'll never know.
Right. You also mentioned transnational activism. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So I guess going back to identities first, another one of my professional identities is that I'm an international development professional. And I've struggled a lot with international development kind of as an extension of colonialism and imperialism. Mm-hmm. But to mm-hmm. me, transnational activism means showing solidarity for people across the world and sharing resources, sharing knowledge in order to ensure that everybody has access to rights and that everybody is able to thrive. So to me, it means dismantling a lot of the power structures that exist globally, especially in a world with so much globalization, so much digitalization. And just the way that the internet is flattening time and space, you know, that can be a really incredible tool for sharing knowledge and kind of collapsing power structures as well. So I'm really interested in that aspect of transnational activism. And I got interested in labor rights because there are just so many things that are obscured from us along the value chain, from the factory where a young woman is producing a t-shirt to the H&M that we go to and buy that same shirt for $3. So a lot of that, I think, needs to be discussed more and to be thought about.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's such a distance between us and our products. And we rarely, if ever, really think about where they come from and how they impact other aspects of other people's lives. That seems like such a big job, transnational activism, international development. That's huge. I mean, talking about dismantling power structures and doing all this, how do you even start? Like, what do you do?
You're right. It's huge. And I think, you know, it can become really paralyzing if you take it on yourself to change everything or presume that you can change everything. So everybody does have a small role to play, but I think it's really us as a collective that has to make the change. And, you know, I've been reading a lot about self-made men and women, and nobody is truly self-made. I mean, besides, you know, maybe starting with a lot of resources and capital or inheriting a lot of wealth, like Kylie Jenner.
Yeah.
You know, I think people don't have success in a vacuum. It's all about the connections that we have, the people who lift us up, the resources that we have based on those around us, kind of our social capital. So I think transnational activism seems less daunting when it's done in a group. And there's so much that can be achieved together that aspect of it is really exciting. And I have to keep thinking about that when I get paralyzed or demoralized or kind of down about the state of the world.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm imagining that you're probably thinking about really difficult things on a really regular basis. And I wonder how often you do feel demoralized.
Yeah, that's also a really good question. And I think it is fairly often. Unfortunately, I do notice that I numb myself to some things sometimes. And I most recently was working kind of a headquarters job, doing work with financial inclusion. So making sure that the unbanked population of the world, which is about a third of people across the world who don't have access to a bank or any financial services, making sure that they have access to services so they can put money in savings so that they can support themselves and their families. And learning more about the folks who are impoverished, food insecure is really depressing. And I feel like in sitting in an office under the fluorescent lighting in DC, I wasn't close to that. And I think there's the need to be close to it. Because it gives you a sense of urgency in your work and responsibility. You know, we're not just acting in isolation, like I said before, but it's been difficult to figure out where that line should be drawn. How much is too much emotional involvement, and when does it lead to burnout? So I've seen a ton of burnout across the sector, and it's no wonder. It makes total sense. And I'm sure that, you know, in your profession that exists as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I relate so much to what you're saying about how depressing certain things can be and how there is a certain amount of emotional investment that we need to engage in. And I definitely struggle with the same thing where it's like, I want to be empathetic and I want to connect with this person who's struggling in front of me. How much is enough and how much is too much to the point where it gets in the way of potentially doing the work together? So it sounds like you haven't quite figured out that line for yourself.
Yeah, definitely still learning that line. I think spending more time working from home has been really helpful in cutting out that time spent commuting. I can kind of redirect my energy or attention to other things and really set an intention for the day and focus on how I'm feeling. I've been trying to do a few pages of journaling every morning, which I think helps. I can kind of dump whatever's on my mind out onto the page before starting and then kind of continue with my day.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So you have found, even being in semi-isolation at home, that you can actually maybe be a little more present with your work.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that I can be a little bit more present for a lot of things. I've done a lot more in-depth reading. I think I've had some pretty valuable conversations with colleagues and friends. There are certain parts of work that have been a little bit more difficult, I think. There's definitely Zoom fatigue. Not necessarily being able to see people's hand gestures or trying to make eye contact and look at the right place on the camera.
You
know, that's a challenge, I think, for a lot of people now, but for the most part, absolutely, it's been good.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I like that phrase, Zoom fatigue. I definitely experience it. Yeah, for sure. You know, you also mentioned a few times the collective. You mentioned about how we don't exist in a vacuum. There's a lot of kind of collaboration that goes on. Especially in your line of work. I'm wondering about, it seems like that's very much like your viewpoint. This is how you look out at the world. You see perhaps the world as a collective, potential for people to work together. Tell me a little bit about that worldview and how you think it impacts maybe some personal aspects of your life.
Sure. I think that worldview, again, was probably forms when I was fairly young. And luckily, yeah, I was exposed to different communities and groups and was able to see how interdependent we were on everybody. And I think that it has informed me in that I value collaboration. I value attempting to elevate all voices kind of in a conversation. Being the person to say yes to a comment, and so being a yes and person, instead of directly opposing what folks are saying. And I think that it's been a process for me to figure out how to insert my voice in the conversation and to tell myself, yes, this matters just as much as everybody else's, because that is what I believe. But in realizing that everybody has a voice, I realize that I have a voice too, and that I might as well use it.
Absolutely. Why do you think that part was a little slower to gain traction in your mind?
That's a really good question as well. I think that I was also trained from a really young age to listen and to be a good listener. You know, my brother has a pretty severe hearing impairment. He does really well. People would never know it often from meeting him. But I think from a young age, I was very invested in making sure that he was able to express himself and maybe kind of stepping back in certain situations. And being very conscious of how he was being perceived and what he was able to do in the different spaces that he was in. So I'm sure that had an impact.
Oh, absolutely. That's really cool. Yeah. So you're just kind of coming to terms with, you know, my voice is as important as other people's voices, those that I've been trying to elevate for all these years. That's really cool. What has that process been like for you? Is it difficult, awkward, challenging?
All of the above, really. Yeah. And yeah, it's really interesting. I was at a retreat back when people could meet together in the same room and like shake hands and hug and all of that. Can barely remember that now, but there was really good activity. The facilitator had everybody go around, partner with someone for 3 minutes and teach them something. The other person could only listen to the person who was teaching. And the thing being taught, you know, it could be a meditation technique. It could be how to count to 10 in Hungarian, things that the other person wasn't likely to know or to have picked up or to use in their professional career. And I thought it was a really good exercise in showing that everybody has something to teach, no matter their rank in the company, no matter their age, and everybody has something to learn. And it was really equalizing. And so that activity could be extrapolated to really any environment. So I think that was a moment when I started to think a little bit more about my role and my voice at the table.
Absolutely. I like that a lot. That's wonderful. That's a great exercise. Do you remember what you taught the person you were with?
Oh, I don't. I think it might have been the Hungarian.
Oh my goodness. So how many languages do you speak? Because I know there are several. I know you speak Spanish.
Yeah, so I'm fluent in Spanish. I speak some pretty basic Mandarin, and I'm learning French.
Oh my goodness. I am surprised but not surprised. That is so cool, Laura. What prompted you to pick up Mandarin and French?
At one point, I really wanted to learn the most commonly spoken languages in the world to be able to like, theoretically talk to the most people on Earth, because I thought that would be really interesting. And so I took Mandarin undergrad and continued taking free classes when I was living in Washington, D.C. And it's fascinating. I love how the characters or the pieces of characters called radicals represent such a different worldview and how they can be broken up to represent different parts of the thing. Like, rooster is fire chicken, for example. It's just really interesting way of expressing things.
That's beautiful. That gives you such a different image than rooster. Fire chicken sounds like that brings a whole different image in my mind.
It's really cool. Yeah, have you encountered any of that with, I know you speak a handful of languages as well.
Yes. Well, not very well anymore. So I spoke Romanian growing up. I was born in Romania. So that's, And I wouldn't say I'm 100% fluent in it anymore. I haven't practiced in a very long time, which is unfortunate. But I did learn Japanese as a kid. So what you're speaking of in terms of characters, they're very similar in the way that they, that Japanese people construct their characters and their language. And yeah, I agree with you. I think it totally changes your viewpoint when you're speaking a different language like that, one that's so completely removed from English, the English language, right? So it's really, really interesting. I'm wondering too about Spanish. So I know you've traveled a lot and you've done a lot of travel in Latin America.
That's right. Yeah, mostly in Latin America.
Okay. Is that why you started learning Spanish, or was the travel a byproduct of learning Spanish?
I think a little bit of both. I think that, you know, kind of the more I traveled in Latin America, the more interested I was in being able to express myself more fluently. It's a very humbling experience that's given me a lot more empathy for English language learners or learners of any other language. Because trying to navigate a new space, find your way to a hostel, ask where the bathroom is, you know, ask for the ingredients in food is really difficult at first and can be, really humbling and really make somebody feel like a child again. But I think that's an important feeling to be aware of and to work through. I'm really grateful that I've been able to do that.
Yeah. What do you think? That's a very interesting point, that feeling of being a child. What do you think that adds, or what kind of benefits does that hold for somebody who's tapping into that childlike feeling?
Yeah, I think that it makes people approach the world a little bit more openly to kind of not take themselves so seriously, to lose all pretenses. Mm-hmm. When you're traveling in a new place and nobody knows you, it doesn't matter who you are, what you've done.
Yeah.
You know, you are in this new space and you need to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to need to ask for help.
And that's something I think a lot of us have forgotten how to do, is ask for help. As adults, that's what I've noticed. That's what I've noticed about myself and about other adults around me, is that we've forgotten how to ask for help, how to admit when we're feeling vulnerable or unsure. I don't know if you've noticed it. Maybe it's different in your field, but I feel like in my field, there's a lot of, there is a lot of pretense, and there's a lot of people kind of pretending to have it all together, to put forth this professional image. Do you feel like that's something you've come across in your field, or is it slightly different?
I definitely have come across that, especially when there's some sort of a consulting role involved, because people do need to represent themselves very professionally. But I've had experiences where, you know, there might be a false piece of information, and I've seen that defended to the end, just because there's so much ego embedded in this work. So definitely have seen that and can relate to what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And how special and beneficial would it be to tap into that childlike aspect at that moment when the ego's trying to take over, right? Like, how beneficial would that be for everybody in the room if we were able to step back? And because I feel like kids don't have big egos most of the time, you know, they're very open and willing to admit when they're falling short. So that's really interesting. I'm curious too, though, I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about like your travel life, because that's one of the things that I know you for, is traveling. I feel like every time I've spoken to you over the last couple of years, you've been somewhere doing something cool. Tell our listeners about your traveling experiences.
Sure. I've traveled a lot in the U.S. I've been to all 50 states. Most recently went to Alaska, so got to check that off the list. And it's been really cool to get to know the U.S. in that way. But I've also traveled a bit through Latin America and the Caribbean. as well as to East Africa for my most recent job, and parts of Europe and Central Asia. And it's been really rewarding to see so many different cultures, to see new sites. And I think the experiences that I take away most are the experiences where I get to connect with people, and have challenging conversations, learn about their perspectives when it comes to national politics or culture, or how they view the US, how they view other countries.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's strange because now, you know, there's not much travel to be had, but I found myself thinking a lot about, there's this aphorism in sociology that you want to try to make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. And I think that's what travel really does best. You're in this new environment. It's very strange after a while. It makes sense. You learn more about the context and the people, and it becomes so normal. And then you return to your home culture, and all of a sudden, everything seems strange there. And so it's this constant shifting of perspectives and zooming in and out. And I love that. And that's been something that I've been able to do without traveling, especially now during these COVID times. And that's been the long-term gift of travel, I think, for me.
How are you making the familiar strange and the strange familiar now when you're not traveling? What does that look like for you?
I think that finding new restaurants to get takeout, maybe stumbling across a video on YouTube about something that I've never heard about, internet black holes, even. I try not to get into them too much, but sometimes going really deep on a topic and, you know, learning about the history of, I was learning about the history of high heels the other day. I listened to a lot of podcasts, just kind of things that we take for granted and normalize. They might be social norms. They might be, you know, objects that we use every day, but aren't common in other cultures. And to really think about them, it's like when you say a word over and over and over again, and it just starts sounding so strange. So I've been trying to do more of that to keep things interesting.
I like that a lot. And I think it speaks to your lifelong learner identity as well. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Do you have any tips for our listeners for how to do that in their own lives?
I would say that it's always really interesting to get recommendations for things to watch and read from friends. And also, you know, maybe from friends who aren't in your immediate circle or who you don't necessarily share a lot of opinions or tastes or interests with. That's a really good starting point.
Nice. I like that. And, you know, as you were talking about this whole idea of making the familiar strange, making the strange familiar, I thought about how we've kind of been doing that during COVID just because of the lockdowns, the shelter in place. Like, I don't know if you experienced this, but when we first went into shelter in place, I really felt like my home life was familiar, but also very strange to me. It was something I didn't really recognize. And I didn't think it would be such a difficult transition because, you know, you kind of think of your home life as, at least I do, as my safe space, and I'm pretty comfortable in it. But when you're actually, you're kind of stuck there, you know, and you can't do your normal routines, it does feel very, very weird. I don't know if you experienced that at all.
I did a little bit. It was very strange to have experienced home as this safe space, and all of a sudden, you know, there was almost this fear that something could come from the outside into it. We were living in a really small Washington, D.C. studio apartment at the beginning of this summer, and alternating who bleached every surface every day. And it was very strange to see that transformation of our routines.
That's definitely an interesting point too, about there's almost like an invasive quality to it. Like something from the outside might come into this safe space and be invasive in some potentially threatening way. I wonder, you know, that makes me think of going back to travel. I wonder if you ever had any sort of experience that you would peg as invasive, like if you ever felt as an invader in another country, if you ever felt like your space was personally invaded while you were traveling. Like, because when you think about travel, it really is kind of, on some microscopic level, a little bit of an invasion where a foreigner comes into somebody else's territory. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I do. Yeah. And that's interesting because I think that I have felt that I've been in both of those positions, both as the person being invaded and the invader, mm-hmm. Especially in countries where I know that the U.S. has had a fraught history with, you know, the local government or with other groups there, and have felt unwelcome in some spaces and completely understand why, and it's because of the historical context, but the ease with which I can navigate certain situations as a white U.S. mm-hmm. American is uncomfortable sometimes, I think, for me to have to think about and mm-hmm. deal with. So have often felt like an innovator in that respect, yeah. and I think have tried to maybe mitigate that with learning more about the language and the cultures and trying to learn more of the local perspective, but it is really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and then I've certainly felt invaded sometimes as a solo female traveler,
yeah.
especially having to avoid catcalls and invitations to people's grandma's lunches.
Oh, goodness. wow. Yeah. So do you do a lot of solo travel then?
I did a fair amount. So I lived in Colombia after I finished my undergraduate degree and was there for a little over a year. So relatively short time, but it felt like a long time at the time, especially the age that I was.
Yeah.
And after I finished, I was on a Fulbright grant and I finished that and had saved like 2/3 of my stipend to just go traveling.
Wow.
And so I met up with friends along the way, but traveled through Central America and parts of Northern South America.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have any like specific memories that come up when you think about that period of your life?
I remember just having the space to do a lot of reflection and to represent myself in any way that I wanted to with new people. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting around a table in Panama City, talking with Venezuelan political activists who'd been thrown out of the country and some of them kidnapped.
Wow.
And, you know, French artists sitting around the same table and just this eclectic group of folks. You know, sharing a beer and talking about their lives. So just really cool people. And I went woofing in Ecuador. Uh-huh. And WOOF is the Worldwide Organization of Organic Farming.
That's right, yeah.
And it's a great way to, especially if you're traveling alone, live with a family, learn how they farm, learn a little bit about their lives, mm-hmm. and have a little bit more of an extended experience in one place. And so I had a really great experience in the mountains of Ecuador. The family really, really took me in. I mean, I was surprised by how much I was treated like their daughter, and really touched by mm-hmm. it. Got to basically live their lives alongside them and do a really horrible job of helping them on their farm. Like,
wow. Wow, Laura, you're just, I mean, I know we've been friends for a while, but I feel like some of these, you're just really surprising me a lot. And I'm thinking about how much courage and hope and maybe blind faith it must take to throw yourself into some of the things that you've thrown yourself into. Where do you get that strength or that drive to do some of these things. I mean, I'm imagining that I would be absolutely terrified. I consider myself a pretty adventurous person, but, you know, listening to you talk, I'm like, oh my goodness, like, you're really adventurous and just really open. What do you think allows you to be that way?
Oh, thanks, Laura. That's really nice of you to say. I think that a lot of it is just kind of committing myself to doing certain things before I have a second thought, honestly. Sometimes it's for the best. Sometimes it doesn't turn out perfectly. And I'm definitely still learning what to commit to and what not to. But I think when it comes to traveling and new experiences, I've often tried to say yes, to be the kind of person to say yes, I'll try it at least once.
Yeah, that is so cool. Do you have any plans for travel post-COVID once all of this is over?
Nothing set yet, but have definitely been daydreaming a lot, been looking at a lot of kind of long trails in different countries to hike and bike, and would love to figure out some sort of a adventure when the time is right.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love that. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, Laura. Like, there's so many things you've said that I want to follow up on and ask you about. Maybe one day we'll do a part two to this interview. I just feel like you're genuinely just such a fascinating person, and you have so much experience under your belt, so much knowledge. So thank you for sharing some of that with us today. I do have one last question for you before we wrap up this episode. So as you know, you've listened to the podcast, Carly and I are really trying to make this podcast about learning, about educating ourselves, about having challenging conversations. So with that in mind, can you share one lesson that you learned this year and how that helped you?
I think this is such a great question. And I really appreciate the mission of this podcast. I think it's really awesome. And I'm really happy that you're doing it. I feel that I've learned a lot of things this year, but I didn't realize it until I really reflected on this. Because in a lot of ways, 2020 feels like a big black hole.
Yes.
You know, what happened this year? I don't know. But one of the things that I've definitely learned, or that has been solidified for me, is that I should not attempt to fill all of the empty spaces. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, sometimes there's silence, sometimes there's a pause, I have time to think, there's no stimulation, I'm not watching anything, I'm not listening to anything, I'm just there with my senses and my thoughts. And often I'll try to make that stop. Yeah. I think especially now, in such a stressful time for everybody, you know, we need to feel connected, and often it's to technology, but can be other things too. But I've been trying to override that impulse and spend a little bit more time with my thoughts, kind of in an unstructured way, feeling completely unproductive, because productivity is not the end goal, and it's not... Mm-hmm. You know, it's overrated.
It is.
Especially now. Yeah. And so to just give myself that time, embrace what feels like emptiness, but is so much fullness.
Yeah.
And really anchors you so much in a sense of place, mm-hmm. like physical place. And so I've been learning and continuing to learn to do more of that for myself.
Yeah. Have you noticed a shift in yourself when you engage with that empty space, or have you noticed a shift in your life? You said it anchors you, or there's the potential to anchor somebody when they're really deep in that empty space. What do you think about that?
Yeah, definitely feel more anchored. I feel like I have a better attention span now. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit less distracted. I feel a little bit more firm in myself and my emotions. Something small isn't as likely to completely throw off my hour or my day, mm-hmm. you know? So it's been, I think, really subtle changes, and hopefully there will be more, but it's been really helpful.
That's beautiful. I love that lesson. I hadn't heard that from anybody before. I really like it. And I think there is a lot of value in sitting in silence. I have the same impulse where if I'm sitting by myself, I need to put music on in the background, or I need to have a podcast on in the background, like some sort of noise to keep me going. So I might take up that challenge and see how it goes for me as well. Thank you for the idea.
Yeah, you'll have to let me know. It was really difficult for me at first, but I'm curious to see how it goes for you
too. Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Laura. That's all the time that we have today. But again, I just really appreciate you being here with us, for lending us your voice, for sharing what it is that you have to share with us. I just really appreciate you. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Laura. This was really fun.